But tonight I'm happy, delighted to welcome Maitra here. She came into the store 4 or 5 months ago, something like that. She immediately liked the store. We had a wonderful conversation, and she suggested that she could do an event here, and I thought that was a wonderful idea. She will be talking about karma and relationships, the ties defined. Welcome to Many Rivers. Thank you.
Thank you. See if I can handle this perch here. This heat seems to be getting to me more than it's getting to you. Maybe because I just came from Oregon. In a way, I would say that probably everybody here could give a talk on karma and relationships. It's something that we're all concerned with and involved with every single day of our lives, isn't it? once you awaken, once you become spiritually aware, which I know that all of you are, then you begin to engage with these kinds of issues. So the first law of the universe is change. The first law of the universe is change. That means that change occurs throughout the universe, on every level, in every way. Change is constantly occurring. And our only choice is to embrace it and work with it or resist it. And we all know what happens when we resist it. Resistance brings contraction, and contraction brings suffering. So we all have that challenge every day of our lives, whatever it is that's happening with us. Do we allow change? Do we embrace it? Do we try to understand it? Do we accept it? Or do we suffer and resist? And we see it not only in our personal relationships, but we see it at the level of countries, at the level of cities, at the level of families, all the different levels. So karma is at work all the time. I want to just briefly give a definition of karma. Karma, you know, the common way of saying it, the young people's way of saying it, if you want to say it that way, is what goes around comes around. What we put out into the universe is what returns to us. We all know the biblical definition, which is what you plant is what you reap. What you sow is also what you reap. But one thing I think most people don't understand about consciousness is that it doesn't have to do so much with the physical plane as it has to do with consciousness. And this is why we can change karma by changing our consciousness, by desiring to change, by desiring to make things better with someone that we've created some karma with, by putting our intention and our will toward repairing things. We immediately begin the process of releasing ourselves from the karmic situation. So a Buddhist saying that I like a lot is, for every little piece of liberation that you attain, you benefit 10 generations forward and 10 generations back. Now, if you spend some time thinking about this, it will blow your mind. Because we haven't really, in America here, we haven't any idea who was there 3 generations back. And if we do, we're lucky. Our parents have helped us with that. Because the way that our lives move and change, we don't really keep up with what happened to our family historically. So we don't really have an idea of what happened 10 generations back. We don't really have a feeling for it. So when I study that or meditate on that idea, what I see is that what it really means is that everyone benefits when we embrace liberation. When we attain any little piece of of liberation, everyone benefits. In front of us and behind us. Everyone benefits. We participate in the change of consciousness on our planet. Every time we make a change within ourselves. So what is going to create world peace? So how are we finally going to have a different experience on this planet? By changing consciousness. We take care of the karma. We raise the consciousness among other people who touch our lives and people who don't touch our lives. And we participate in the creation of the peace and harmony that we're all hoping for on this planet. So I see the little picture as the same as the big picture. The trouble that we have with our lover, the trouble that we have with our daughter or our son or our parents, is the same thing being played out as what we're playing out between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The same thing that we're seeing playing out around the planet. And I also see that when we recognize that it's all us human beings in process, then we decide how we want to engage that process, how we want to, what contribution we want to make. And we begin to understand that it's not in some big world-shaking project that we might have in the back of our minds that someday we might like to take part in, but it's in the little things that we do and practice every day, the way that we treat each other. Even when it comes down to it, the way that we treat ourselves, whether we treat ourselves with love and compassion, and then let that generate itself out to other people. So if you find that you're being, that you're sabotaging yourself a lot, if you find that you're angry at yourself a lot, if you find that you're speaking to yourself in a negative way, you can start right there. And that will begin to do the process of changing consciousness and changing karma. There's another Buddhist saying that I like a lot. I think it applies here. It says, in the West, we say, don't just stand there, do something. We always think we have to be fixing everything, don't we? Don't just stand there, do something. I remember my mother saying that to me. And the Buddha says, don't just do something, stand there. And I think it's that standing there, it's that not just doing something, but just standing there that allows for the change in consciousness. That's what gives you that moment and that opening to reflect on what's going on and move it to another level and engage at a different level with the people that you're working with. So don't just do something. Stand there. Be there with yourself. Be there with your consciousness. You know, if we lived our consciousness, all of this would be unnecessary to talk about, because we all have this consciousness. We have it. We just aren't able, in the heat of the moment, we aren't able to apply it or live it in the way that we believe. So if the only thing you did was say, okay, I'm going to start living what I know, I'm going to start living what I really understand, everything would begin to transform. I wanted to sort of condense this, so I made myself some notes. As long as consciousness remains the same, karma remains the same. One key to changing consciousness is to, oh, it's so simple, stay awake. Stay awake. I had a friend once who was studying biofeedback, And he hooked his brain up to this biofeedback instrument, and he walked around for 48 hours watching the effect on every action in his brain. And he was looking to see how much of the time he could keep himself awake. And he discovered by having this instrument there and having feedback all the time, he still could only stay awake about 60% of the time. And his theory was that we probably, most of us, are awake about 20 to 25% of the time. That's a pretty stunning idea. And we all know what it feels like to be driving down the road and all of a sudden shake our head and realize we didn't even remember when we went over that bridge and when we went by that street that we were watching for. We didn't even notice because we went to sleep. Maybe we left our bodies. Maybe we were thinking about yesterday. Maybe we were making plans for tomorrow. The thing is that we were not in the moment. We were not. In order to stay awake, you have to stay present in the moment. Much more difficult than we think it is. Much more difficult. And if you sit with enlightened beings, one of the things that you notice, it's really remarkable, and it happens with every single one of them, is that they're not anywhere else but here. They're not making any plans for tomorrow. They're not regretting anything that happened 3 hours ago. They're not thinking about yesterday. They're present right here and now with us. And we can learn to do that more by having a strong intent. By beginning to recognize when we drift away, when we're going into the past, when we're going into the future, and bringing ourselves back into the present moment. So, in this sort of condensed version of something that I do a lot of talking about, I wanted to give you some foolproof or guaranteed, and I really love this word, guaranteed, because I think it's almost become without meaning, but I still want to use it just to get your attention. Some guaranteed ways to improve the relationships that you have. In other words, if you can put these things, these concepts, into practice in your life, I guarantee you things will improve. Things will change. I give you my personal guarantee. Luckily, I'm not going to be there if it doesn't work. But So the first one I've already mentioned, and that is being present. The more you can learn to be present, the more you're going to see in your relationships, the more you're going to become conscious and aware in your relationships. And things are going to be different if you're really there. Now, I think it's a good idea to aim for 100%, but I have to tell you, I'm not sure anybody ever gets there. Even the enlightened ones, I think, are in process with that. So, but aim for it anyway. Aim for it. Start to notice when your mind is wandering and start to gently bring yourself back into the moment. And becoming aware of your breath will help you with that. Just when you notice that you're drifting, take a breath and say, okay, I want to be here right now. I want to be here right now. Remember Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now, many years ago? So that's one of the guarantees, that if you can learn to be more present, relationships will change. Okay. Here's a good one. Give up blaming. Now, I think a lot of our blaming of other people is done unconsciously, and we do it when we're trying to look for who's at fault, when we're trying to understand what happened and what we did wrong or what somebody else did wrong. What's implicit in that is we're looking for who gets the blame. And some years ago, not very long ago, the Japanese taught us some things about doing business. And what we discovered was that Americans and Westerners in general spend a lot of time, if something goes wrong, trying to find out who was to blame. Who did it wrong? Who was the one who made the mistake? Who was the one who did something wrong? And the Japanese spend no time on that at all. They say, okay, this is what went wrong. Now what are we going to do about it? How are we going to make it better? How are we going to prevent it from happening again? And they didn't need to chase down whose fault it was. So in your life, if you can give up this sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle desire to find who's at fault, to blame, and that includes yourself, if you can just give that up, whew, space will open, I promise you. Space will open. There will be openings for expansion. Because blame, again, is a contraction. And a contraction always limits the amount of consciousness that can come into the situation. Always, without exception. So what we want, of course, is an open mind, an open attitude, an openness, an open approach. And this has probably got to be one of my favorite ones. If you can begin to accept and understand this, believe me, everything will change. This is the concept. Nothing is personal. Absolutely nothing is personal. Now, let me explain that. And this idea, this concept comes from a wonderful teacher from the Berkeley area named Patricia Sun. And she describes it like this. She says, you walk into a room and you look out the window and you see the moon. And you say, oh, great to see you, moon. Hello, where have you been? How are you? Blah, blah, blah. And the moon doesn't say anything. The moon just, you know, continues doing what it's doing, continues being the moon. And you walk out of the room, and you come back in again, and the moon has moved from one side of the window all the way over to the other side. And you say, moon, what are you doing? I didn't know you were going to, you didn't say anything to me about doing that, moving over there. What are you doing? Gosh, you never talked to me about anything. And the moon doesn't say anything. The moon just keeps on being the moon. And then you leave the room again, and you come back in again, and the moon is gone, and you throw yourself down on the floor, and you beat your hands on the floor, and you say, moon, how could you do this to me? You never loved me. You never cared about me. You just always have to be your own selfish self. The moon's gone, so the moon doesn't say anything. What did the moon do?
Nothing.
Nothing. The moon just kept on being the moon. It just simply kept on. The moon insists on being the moon. Have you noticed? Nothing will sway the moon from being the moon. Okay, now what if you saw every single person in your life like the moon? What if you could look at every single person in your life and say, that person is just insisting on being themselves, like the moon. And that means that nothing I do or say is going to keep that moon from being, from going along its way, from going along its path, from being itself. Can you imagine what would happen if you didn't take anything personally? If you really refuse to take anything personally? If you just allowed everyone to be themselves with no judgment, with no hurt feelings? So if you start working with this concept, then you begin to see how your own mind is what's creating the hurt feelings. How you create your own suffering by the way, by what you project onto other people, when everybody's just being themselves. Now, this doesn't mean that you're going to like to have everyone around you. Sometimes when people are being themselves, you might decide, I don't want this moon in my life anymore. You have a right to decide what you want and what you don't want in your life. But if you don't take it personally, it's going to be a lot clearer. Because in taking it personally, we open up a whole can of worms about trying to change other people, don't we? We think, if I just did this different, if I just understood better, if I just acted differently, maybe then they would be different too. Which can't happen with the moon, right? Can't. So instead, what we begin to say is, does my relationship with this person enhance my life? Or does it drain me of energy? If it drains me of energy, then I need to consider whether I want to stay in relationship with this person or not. Not judging them, not making them better or worse, but just, this is the effect it has on me, and I don't like it, I don't want it. I remember very clear the moment when I accepted my first husband exactly the way he was. And the reason I remember it very clearly is because immediately I knew my relationship with him was over. And I loved him the way he was. He didn't have to change anything for me to love him. But for me to live with him, I didn't belong there anymore. You see what I mean? It isn't that it solves every problem in your life. You still have to decide what your action is going to be. But it makes things a lot clearer when you stop taking things personally. Okay? So, a couple more, and then I want to do some mini readings to show you a little bit how I work. Because one of the reasons why I'm here is because I want to open up the possibility of doing readings here in this area, and maybe someday even some workshops. Okay, so I want to talk about the old paradigm. The old paradigm that our parents worked with, and their parents, and their parents, and that really a lot of the world still works with, is if I'm right, then you have to be wrong. And if I'm wrong, then you have to be right. Somebody's got to be right and somebody's got to be wrong if we're having a disagreement, right? Somebody's got to be right and somebody's got to be wrong. Well, the new paradigm says, okay, so the old paradigm said either or. Either you're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and you're wrong. Can't be both. The new paradigm says both you and I have validity in the way that we see things. Both your way of seeing and my way of seeing are valid. Now, when they don't agree, we have to see if we can find a place where we can come together anyway. And I think if we could apply this new paradigm in, let's say, the Israelis and the Palestinians again, what if these guys could each one give up all those lists of things that they feel so righteous about, and say, okay, we've both made mistakes, and obviously it isn't working. We can't live together in peace if we keep hanging on to these old ways of seeing things. So what if we just give all that up and say, okay, you have your way of seeing and I have my way of seeing, and let's just look to see if there's any place where we have some agreement, where we can begin to kind of stretch our hands across the abyss and begin to touch each other as brothers, as the brothers and sisters that we are. Imagine what would happen. Now, if we do this in our lives, if we stop thinking that our way of thinking is right and the other guy's way of thinking therefore has to be wrong, or what, you know, I see a lot of women doing is, women, if somebody disagrees with them, women will often say, okay, I must be doing something wrong here. What's wrong with the way I'm doing this? What if we give that up, even? What if we even give that up and say, okay, here's my position and here's your position. Now, where can we find each other in this? Where can we find each other? So the new paradigm is both and. Both your position and my position have validity. And if we start from there, then we can find some common ground. And the old paradigm, which hasn't worked for many, many, many centuries, to bring peace to the world, at least, it hasn't worked. I suppose it's worked if you like having war. Either or. Either you're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and you're wrong. So begin to catch yourself when you find yourself taking a position, and begin to just open up the space for both positions to have validity. Okay, begin to catch yourself there. I promise you it will change things. Okay, one more, and then I want to do a few mini readings. This is my theory, and I'm not sure if I really originated this or if I read it somewhere and then forgot. But what I see in working with couples and with people in general is that if you see things 50-50, if you say, okay, I did my 50%, now where's the other guy going to do his 50%? If you see it that way, it never quite works. So what we need to do is give 100%. If each of us gives 100%, or even if only one of us, if we give our own 100%, everything will begin to change. Because have you noticed what happens when you see it as 50-50? You start to gauge what you're doing, and you look for whether the other guy's gonna come forward with their 50% or not. Well, he's not willing to meet me halfway, so I don't want to do it anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore. We catch ourselves in that dilemma. But if you can say to yourself, I've done everything I can, everything I could possibly think of, then you can at least be at peace with yourself. And in general, when you give 100%, something is going to change in the way things are going, because there's no more bargaining going on. You're not bargaining anymore. Okay, let's see. Oh, I want to say one more thing before I stop. A few years ago, there was a wonderful study done at the University of Washington where they would have couples come in to their... it was really a studio. They would come in and live and be observed in everything they did, videotaped, verbally taped. Everything they did was on view. And what they were studying was what works in relationships, what works in marriages. And at the end of the study, they had defined 5 different kinds of marriages that they said kind of blow up our ideas of how a marriage should be or how it should work. In other words, they had one model in which people fought all the time, but it worked for them. They had another model where people didn't talk to each other hardly ever, but it worked for them. And the way they defined what worked and what they said made the difference between relationships that work and the ones that don't. There was one particular thing that could be actually counted. They could watch the video and count how many times these things happen. And they said there was one thing that all these marriages had in common. And I want to expand that to say all relationships, because I'm not sure that it only has to do with marriages, but we could just say partnerships. That for every criticism or hurt, there were 5 expressions of love. And they could count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. For every criticism or sharp word that was spoken, there were 5 expressions of love. Not necessarily verbal expressions, sometimes just a hand on the shoulder, kiss on the cheek, fixing somebody's favorite meal, doing something that shows that you care. So 5 expressions of love for every, should we say negative? For every negative. So in your relationships, especially if you have a partner, you might begin to look at that and see what happens with that. Because there are so many things that happen to interfere with that in most relationships. If we're angry, if someone said something to hurt us and we're angry, our heart shuts down, doesn't it? We don't wanna express love anymore. We don't want to do the nice thing. The nice thing might cross through our minds and we say, after what he did, I'm not going to do that. You know, we get our negative patterns going. So you might want to just check that out for yourself in whatever relationships you have going on right now, or the ones that you had in the past also. If you get going on a downward spiral, that's what kills relationships. So the thing that kept these 5 different types of relationships awake and aware and working, functioning, was this one little secret. And this wasn't a secret that any of these people had defined for themselves. It was the one that the study revealed. None of these people knew they were doing that. But their hearts were engaged enough in the relationship that they were expressing love 5 times as many times as they were expressing negativity. That's interesting, huh? Yeah. Okay, so if there are questions or comments, I'm happy to have that. And otherwise, I'd like to do some mini readings for you. And we can do that from a number of different perspectives. If you have an issue that you're working with in your life right now and you'd like me to just have a look at it for you, give you some feedback, I can do that. If you want to look at a past life, that's been my sort of primary. That was the way that my third eye opened, was by seeing people's past lives. And it's been a pretty strong part of my work ever since, the karmic patterns, the past life influences that we're all subject to all the time. if you just want me to give you a general sense of what I see when I look at you, I can do that too. So. Yes.
Is the common bias of the Israeli-Palestinian issue that they live together? And if so...
Is the common bias, you mean?
The common view.
The common view that they live together?
What,
say it another
way.
What's
the goal?
Hmm? Oh, what would I like to see happen? What would I like to see happen? I'd like to see them live together in peace, yes. I'd like to see them become good neighbors to each other. Let the past go. If that's what you're asking.
And in the same land?
In the same land, yes.
Then how do you talk in those terms about the Israeli-Palestinian situation with a relationship one-on-one such as you have with your first husband? You no longer live with them.
Oh, you are a stinker. Okay.
Well, I'm trying to understand.
Well, he can live next door, but just not in the same house.
I'm trying to understand this notion of a loving relationship.
Well, I have neighbors that I don't really have a relationship with, don't you?
But you're neighborly to them.
I'm neighborly to them. Right. I speak to them, and right. If something is happening in the neighborhood that needs to be addressed, I'm there with it. But yeah, I don't really see a contradiction. But I get your point too.
Well, I'm not sure what my point is.
Well, I think your point is, how does that work in practical terms? And I'll tell you that with my first husband, I'm friendly with him. I mean, I don't have a problem with having a relationship with him. We have children, and we continue to have an amicable relationship. But I'm not married to him anymore. I don't think the Palestinians and the Israelis need to get married. I just like to see them live together harmoniously for myself. I mean, I don't know that that's what any of them want. What is it? I saw a report on television, I think, about one little village. It's in the Israeli area, where the Palestinians and the where people do live together, and their children go to school together, and they're friendly with each other. And it was presented as proof that could happen if everyone was willing to let go of all the hurts and all the justification for war. I mean, it can always justify war if you want to.
Actually, I think you did answer my question when you described the couple who argued quite a bit.
Yeah.
But they gave five acts of love to each other for every one.
Hurt.
And so it was probably volatile.
Yeah.
It was a volatile relationship, but it was a loving relationship.
And I think that the point that they were making was that there's not a single workable way to have a relationship, but if you can keep your heart open, then you can then your relationship can function.
If you love more than you criticize.
If you love more than you criticize. Five times more. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
When you say one hurt and five, you know, positives, or is it like that the one person who gave the hurt offering all five of them, or is it mutual? Like one person did two and one did three and it always equals five?
It's if you say something hurtful, you then express love five times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Each person.
Mm-hmm. Each person. And they said they were astonished when they first discovered this pattern and looked back over their old tapes and were able to see that it functioned every time. With every couple that had a really functioning, workable relationship. Imagine, I mean, if the whole world could put that to use.
So if I never put my foot in my mouth, I never have to speak love.
Well, you don't believe that. You just like to make a joke.
No, that's true.
Well, I think you could learn to enjoy putting your foot in your mouth.
I was thinking about what you said about women, you know, and turning it on yourself. And I'm thinking of my daughter. I've had a very challenging relationship since she was very little. And so it's been interesting because I keep having to work with, still with, what can I say positive to her, even if she's like me or, you know, has her sarcasm. And then the more that I am present with myself, you know, the more that I can see that she's always been like this, you know, and to keep reminding. But it is a challenge, you know, to not take it personally and see what else can I do?
Yeah.
How else can I change myself? What else can I do to make this, you know, more peaceful, you know, and loving? And, you know, I've learned things about, like, not to meet her with it, to sidestep it more and just go do something else for the time until that kind of goes and hear more of a deaf ear about, you know, what that is, because I can see more perception about that she has a lot on her plate and it's just her. And for me, just, you know, when you grow up a certain way, afraid of anger because you grew up in an alcoholic family or something.
Yeah.
And then you have a child whose primary expression is in anger, who doesn't experience sorrow, or and there's someone you don't quite understand. And so it takes you a lifetime to really perceive, you know, a different, you know, what that's all about. Sometimes it takes a lot of years.
Okay. So let me make a comment about her. Always behind anger is hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Always. Whenever you see anger, there's some hurt. And if there's a lot of anger, there may be a number of hurts that never got addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So your daughter does have sorrow, but she's choosing to express anger.
Yeah, and it's funny because when she was little, it used to come up where she would feel really, you know, like taken aside, like as if I'd taken sides. And I said, well, it's just that it's a little easier to reach for one of your brother who's crying and you don't want me near you. Like, I try to approach you, but you bang your head or you don't want me in your space, so I don't really know how to approach you and comfort you in that anger. But it has continued to be a challenge.
Yeah.
I
remember with my daughter, she just wouldn't communicate with me. She wouldn't talk to me. And her room was right across the hall from my room. So every time we'd have a fight, and I wanted to talk to her about it afterwards, I would write her a letter and slip it under her door. And she never talked to me about it, but it got softer. It got easier. It got more workable because she could feel, she let it in when she read the letter, she let it in that even though I was fighting with her about something or we disagreed, I loved her anyway. But like your daughter, it was really hard to find any opening to give it to her. So you might.
Oh. If only you had known, you could have slipped 5 letters under.
Five letters?
5 letters.
Oh, I slipped. I did over the time. I did slip 5 letters. You could be a stand-up. You would be on Ananda. Are you?
I'll do it sitting down.
Yeah. But just remember that when she's angry, something's hurting. Sometimes it's easy to forget that. I remember this teacher that I had. His name was Jim, and he was a black man. And he said that one time he was driving through Oakland, and he was stopped by the police. And they jerked him out of his car, and they threw him down on the pavement. And tied his hands behind his back and searched him. And when they took out his identification, they realized he wasn't the man they thought he was. And he said they stood him up again and they took the cuffs off. And they said, sorry, you're not the person we thought you were. And he said he stood there for a long moment and he felt this anger just coursing through his body. And then he let it go. He let the anger move through his body, and then he just started to cry. And he said within about 2 minutes, two of the guys had tears in their eyes, too. And the third one actually had to go get back in his car because he didn't want anybody to see that he was crying. And he said when he went to the deepest truth of himself, when he went to the deepest truth of himself, the other people went there with him. And so there was the pain and the sorrow of one human being treating another one in this way.
He didn't retaliate.
He didn't retaliate at all. No, he said first he felt the anger. He felt it just light him up. But he just let it keep moving and let it move on through. And then the tears were there. So. Okay, yes.
I think we should ask the Israeli and the Palestinian leaders to start their meeting by crying.
Good luck.
It would be an interesting experiment,
maybe
wouldn't it?
Maybe they would start to communicate. And
I think they are crying, you know, all the time. They're crying all the time. There's so much pain.
Anger, yeah.
I have a connection with a person that's in Israel right now, and she told us a really wonderful story about the Palestinians going through these checkpoints and the Israeli soldiers being really rough with them.
Yeah.
So these Israeli women started to stand about 50 feet back from the checkpoint, and they just stood there. And when a Palestinian would come through and the Israeli soldiers would rough them up, they would just go like that. And within a few weeks,
we see you.
It changed completely.
Wow.
She said these women were the mothers and grandmothers of these Israeli soldiers.
Yeah.
Maybe not the ones at that particular checkpoint,
but
some ones.
Yeah.
All they did was go like that, and it changed it.
They brought consciousness into the situation.
Yeah.
And the karma started to move and dissolve. Yeah. They brought awareness. Wake up, wake up. Yeah, beautiful story. Yeah, beautiful. Didn't someone else have their hand up over here for a reading? Yeah.
Yeah, I would do a reading, I guess, I was thinking, but about a relationship. I sort of feel like I have the answer now after talking, you know, with you and listening, but there was another subject was this anger thing is really what I've been dealing with, or just having an emotion that isn't really the deepest emotion, you know, and being able to, I see now that really all we can do is just to watch it and not really act on it.
Yes.
Do something, stand there. I like that one. That really helped me. So, but I suspected that there was something below the anger, and I didn't. I know they talk about all these different gradations of emotion, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that. We can't just go around crying all the time. But I guess we can. To accept that. I mean, like in the workplace, I have to deal with certain things like that when I'm working.
Well, the more you cannot take things personally,
the less anger will happen.
The less hurt there will be. You know, it'll become less. It just begins to be less.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
So do you want to do the reading or just...
Sure, yeah, yeah. What do you want me to read? What do you want? What's your...
The biggest thing is this, I think, this relationship that seems to be a life relationship, even though we've been divorced for 5 years and don't live together, but we still seem to have some...
You have children together?
No.
No? But you still are relating
to
each other.
We're still very close, and yet it's almost like we can't live together. We don't have... Our personalities don't really work very well in the same, you know. But we seem to have some purpose of still hanging out together and being together. There seems to be some kind of... But it never seems to show up with being an important relationship. And it seems like it is.
Say your first name and your birth date.
Karen, June 8th, 1954.
And then say his.
June 8th, 1951. I know, it is weird. I know, that's why it's hard for us not to feel there's something.
Wow, what's his name?
His name is Neil.
Okay. Oh, it's a. What's showing is a war situation. Maybe it's the First World War, and he was your oldest son who. Your husband had been killed, and you had four children. He was your oldest, and he was your oldest son, and he had just he's about 15 years old when his father died, and he had just taken hold of the responsibility. He just became like a husband to you. He became not. He didn't try to take over, take your authority away from you at all, but he just came as a partner. He just came up into the role of partner. And when the war came, he was, what do they call that? Conscripted. He was conscripted. And you tried to convince them that he was the man of the house, but they weren't.
He couldn't go. I was trying to get
him. That you tried to keep him there with you, but he they wouldn't let him. You had orchards. You had fruit and olives, and you had trees, orchards. There was a lot of work with it, and he was. You have them now. You have some trees now.
No, he's a. Landscape architect kind of person.
Okay. That's probably in college right now.
Yeah.
He feels what's going on. Anyway, you spent the rest of the war, waiting to hear what was happening with him, waiting for the war to be over. There was this feeling of waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And you have that feeling now sometimes.
Now, yeah,
yeah, waiting and waiting and waiting for something. And he never came home. He was killed, but he was never accounted for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
He was lost.
Never,
so you never knew what happened to him. So I think it's really hard for you to let go of it all the way now because. You know, here he is, and you value him. You value each other. And when he died, he also felt, what will mom do now? What will my mother do now? How can she manage without me? There was this feeling of responsibility that he had taken on this responsibility for you.
Wasn't able to fulfill it,
right. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay.
Thanks.
Welcome. I hope that's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I would like to know about the past life of my current, the past life that's affecting my current partnership.
The past life. You can tell that there's something karmic between
you. No, you were very good with her karma, past life stuff.
And oh, that, okay. So you want to see what
your
specialty.
That's your specialty. So
well, it sort of is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I consider myself a student of it, however. So your first name and birth date?
Charles, February 1st, 1955.
Okay. And your partners?
Autumn, January 8th, 1955. 66.
Okay. Wow. Is it you or is it her that has throat chakra issues? Are you a truth speaker?
Sometimes.
Is she?
Probably not.
Uh-huh. And is this one of the issues?
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Communication. Yeah.
Throat chakra.
Yeah. Throat chakra. Communication. And from my point of view, always having to do more with the specific aspect of communication that has to do with speaking the truth. That when the throat chakra opens, it's it's almost impossible to lie. It, you can still do it, but you pay for it, because it demands of you that you speak the truth or keep your mouth shut. Sometimes it demands of you that you speak too. So I think it's the French court, and it must have been prior to the revolution, right? There was no court after the revolution. You had some sort of a title, or you were coming into a title. You were from a family that was. Would be considered the nobility. She was a hairdresser. She was, you know, those elaborate, huge hair things that the women wore then? I can see, you know, sometimes they're 3 or 4 feet high. They're amazing. She was an expert at this, and because of that was called, she was around the court all the time. People knew her, and she, in some way, she was on the periphery, but also she knew people, and she was kind of peripherally included. I mean, she's not nobility, so there's a difference, but I don't know. There's some sort of way in which she was had a sort of a special status because of her talent, her artistic talent. Is she an artist now? Mm-hmm. Of some kind?
No.
No. Okay. You fell in love with her. And you resisted it. You were young. I think you were not in... You were not... You didn't have a... Did they have some way in which you had a pre-title to a title? I don't know. I don't know why this is important, he was going to have his title when his father died.
Yeah.
And you were pretty young. You were younger than she was. And at first you were just thinking to have an affair with her. First you were just thinking I can't consider her really as a life partner. But you approached her in that way, and she was very she was friendly, but she wasn't going to be used. She wasn't going to be used. And you kept kind of coming toward her in a way of almost like courting, only you knew it wasn't anything permanent. But and then you discovered that you really liked talking to her, and then the more you got to know her, the more you were feeling kind of obsessed with her. And when you would talk to other people about it, they would say, well, of course, you can have her as a mistress. And you said, but she's not going to be anybody's mistress. She told me she's not interested in being a mistress. And anyway, you were in love with her for quite some time, and even went to your father and said, I know that this isn't done, but I'd like to marry her, you said to your father. And he said, he laughed. He said, there's no way you're going to bring her into the family. And he immediately sent you away. I think he sent you to America. And you thought that was a good thing. You thought yeah, it makes sense to me. If I can't marry her, then it's silly to keep staying around her and feeling all these feelings that I'm having. And she just had made it very clear what her boundaries were. And when you came back from America, she was married to someone else. A guard, a man, he had prestige, but of a different kind. He was a soldier. Yeah. And so it never got resolved. It never got resolved. And you felt for the rest of your life, and it wasn't very long because then the revolution came. you felt like you sorry, but you always felt like she was the love of your life, and that and somehow you thought there was something wrong with you because of this, that you yes, that there must be something. Well, you were well indoctrinated into the superiority of the nobility. But somehow it didn't work when it came to your heart. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, how are we doing on time?
It's about 8:40.
Okay, so how much?
Five, 10 more minutes.
All right.
Would that be agreeable?
Sure, yeah. Yes.
Mine's about my living situation.
Okay.
I haven't had a real solid living situation in a long time. And I found this kind of perfect place that I thought would be healing and good for me. And it's not environmentally, spiritually, emotionally for me.
You got the place.
I got the place.
Yes.
It was like this big competition.
Okay.
The market.
Okay.
And it feels kind of dark to me. There's some mold problems in there, and I'm just not.
So let me ask you something. Is what you're really saying that you're looking for your home?
I am.
Yeah. And you're looking outside for your home.
For a sanctuary.
Yes. You're looking out here for your home, and you have these criteria that you think are going to satisfy that.
Well, it's not anything extreme. I want quietness. And
you're missing my point.
No, I got it.
Yeah. Home is in here. Find it in here, and then wherever you are, you'll be at home. That's what you're longing for. That's what you've been longing for all your life. You felt really like you landed with the wrong family, didn't you?
Yes and no.
Did you feel at home with your family?
Did
you feel like you could be yourself?
Not completely.
Okay. Now let it in. That somehow it's not, you haven't found the space where you feel that you can be yourself and be at home with yourself. You just haven't found that yet. And you're not going to find it out here. Nobody finds it out there. And people who do find it still haven't found it. I mean, you may find the perfect place to live, but if you're not at home with yourself yet, you realize it doesn't work. This is why I say to people, if you want a Cadillac or whatever it is today,
Lexus,
if you want a Lexus, go get a Lexus, because, and make whatever sacrifice you have to make, because you need to find out that that's not what it is you really want. You understand? What you really want is you. You want you. You want to be at home and at peace with yourself. Am I making any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So put your heat seeking missile in the right direction. You know, put it this way. You understand? Yeah. Because if you keep looking for it out here, you will always be disappointed. Something will be wrong. But when you have it in here, then whatever is outside of you, you'll be able to manage it. When you're right with you. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. Shall I? Do I dare?
Well, you're standing up, so you can do the humor.
I'm not standing
up. You're taller than
me. I'm up above you. Okay.
I've had a problem connecting with women. So I'm not sure if that's going to be ending or why it happened in the past. Or I don't understand it very well.
So tell me what it is about women that you're afraid of. And I liked what you did then. You opened up more.
Hmm.
Yeah. You don't have to answer right now, but it's the question you need to answer. What is it that I'm afraid of? May I ask you, was your mother manipulative?
She was strong.
Was she manipulative? Did she always get her way?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you start to see the picture I see?
Yeah, afraid I won't be able to be free in a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So by looking at the fear...
You have to begin to see the difference between a woman that you're interested in and your mother. You have to begin to stop seeing your mother every time you look at a woman.
Mm.
And one good way to do that is just to name it as it comes up. This situation is making me remember what it was like with my mother. And then the minute you name it, then the energy can dissipate and you can be more present with the person that you're with.
Mm.
Yeah, it feels like it's somehow your heart says, in order to be loved, I have to give something up.
Mm.
I have to give up my free will, perhaps, I don't know exactly the right words.
Mm.
But that's the program that got installed with your mother. And so you have to uninstall that program.
Mm.
I always have to have somebody else come and do it for me, but but maybe you know how to do that on your computer. I don't know.
Mm.
But you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Uninstall that idea that you can't be yourself and have your freedom and love somebody and be loved.
Mm.
Yeah. Your mother was strong. Yeah.
My theory was a love. Love she could hate. Be angry, but she could be very loving, so I was getting both of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Push and pull.
Yeah. There's a book called If You See the Buddha in the Road, Kill Him.
Mm.
Okay. So what it means really is if you see something outside of yourself that you think is more holy than you, you have to destroy that idea. So when you see, so I say to people, when you see your parents in the road, kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And that same idea that the parent is the authority, the original authority in our lives, and at some point we have to take our own authority. And once you do that, then you don't have to be afraid of what women are going to do or not do. Then you can just be yourself and realize everything is negotiable. In a functioning relationship, everything is negotiable.
Mm.
Yeah. And when you need space and time, you can say, I need space and time, and take it.
Mm.
And it'll be all right.
Mm.
Which it wasn't with your mother. She wanted to define when that happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. soul. You understand? If I want, I hesitate to say this, but I'm going to say it. Kill your mother.
I'm killing her as we speak.
Good. Take away her power.
Yeah. Yes.
Take away the power that she still has.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Yeah. Okay. Yes. One more.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I was just wondering about my current relationship and if there's a karmic connection or
okay.
What you see there.
Okay. Okay, so your name and birthday first.
Okay, my name is Chelsea, and it's 8/24/84.
Okay. You have fear, and though. You have a lot of fear with your around your heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the hurt that you've had before, you're protecting your heart a lot, mm-hmm. as you begin to move into deeper levels of intimacy in this relationship. So. The person's name and birthday.
His name is Cesar, and uh-huh. It's February 14th of 1984.
Uh-huh. So is he Hispanic?
Yes, Guatemalan.
But American?
Yes.
Born here?
No.
No.
Born in Guatemala.
Okay, well. Always some challenges in cross-cultural relationships. Always some very specific challenges, and the culture that he comes from sees men as superior to women, and so maybe your fear is justified. I don't know. You have to bring the issues out into the open and address them and see how that works. And if you can get through those things when they come up, if you to your satisfaction, then you have a possibility of a lasting relationship. So don't be afraid to test this relationship to see whether his mind and his heart are open enough to move out of all the cultural programming that he has into a more liberated kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. And I say that knowing that there's something that attracted you to him, and it could be that you like his, what's the word, macho-ness?
Dominance.
Dominance? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could be. You have to look inside yourself to see, is that attractive to you?
Right, but I think I was attracted to him because of the opposite of that. He's very not ego-driven and very, very culturally very different than a typical
okay.
Guatemalan man.
Still, that's the programming that's running underneath everything.
Okay.
So test it. Test it and see whether that persona that he's presenting to you right now is genuine.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to test it. And do that before you marry him. See whether you can move through those differences and find a common ground.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very enjoyable.
Thank you for a very special, insightful, helpful evening.
Oh,
so
good.
For all of us and for the people. I'm really delighted. You know, thank you.
You're welcome.